which is supposed to equip one with the ultimate knowledge and therefore power. Other figures and characters are the CIA and its head Inoue Sato. Somehow they seem to be the bad guys at the beginning, but that image changes until the end of the book. And there is a Freemason, like Peter Solomon is also one, Warren Bellamy, who at the same time is also the architect of the Capitol. Searching the ancient mysteries, Langdon and Solomon's sister get caught by Mad Melech, who turns out to be Peter's son, thought to have been died, to have died years ago. Both survive, Melech, a.k.a. Zachariah Solomon, and Peter, who doesn't tell him the truth about the secret word. The CIA turns up, Melech dies, and all others survive with one hand more or less. Peter takes Langdon and Catherine to the Washington Monument and is revealed that the last words were actually Laus Deo, praise God, and that the word actually stands for the Holy Scripture, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, you name it. This explanation, the fact that all knowledge lies within these books, is so convincing and somehow satisfying that Langdon's last thought is hope. In this short summary, I left out all of the twists, half-dead and non-dead persons, and knowledgeable comments on Freemasonry, Newton, and the architecture of buildings in Washington. But I hope you have all read the book, parts of it, title. Reading an interview with Dan Brown in a German magazine, it turns out that Brown, just like Langdon, finally converted to a real believer, who doesn't need Christ, but feels spirituality when walking on the beach during sunrise. Right now, Brown is busy building a house for him and his wife, and this is not a joke, a house with secret corridors, movable shelves, and hidden doors. Before I start with the introduction of the panel participants, I just want to repeat the center has no agenda, nor does it get any money from Dan Brown, his publishers, or the ones who sued him. Our research is based on academic purposes solely. I may start with Dr. Andreas Onofosch, the director of the center. Andreas received his PhD at the University of Greifswald. He studied in 18th century Freemasonry in Sheffield and is interested in breast history and the history of sciences in general. Currently, he's preparing a monograph on Freemasonry as topic in 18th century of breast. Next to him, Dr. Robert Collis, who came to the center as honorary research fellow. Rob received his PhD from the University of Turku in Finland last year in February. His current research is focused on the influence of Western physicians transferring esotericism to Russia between the early 1500s until 1917. And the third one, still a pretty new face at the center, is Dr. Robert Peter, a senior assistant professor in the Institute of English and American Studies at the University of Szeged, Hungary, where he teaches modern British history. He received his PhD on English Freemasonry between 1815 from the same university. As a British Academy researcher in Sheffield, he is currently completing a book on the religious aspects of 18th century English Freemasonry and investigating the Masonic references in 18th century newspaper articles of the Bernay collection. And now I shall leave it to the three to tell us something we didn't and probably couldn't see in the book and give us their personal assessments. I propose that we call Robert Collis Rob and Robert Peter Robert, so it makes it easier.
Thank you very much, Dorothy, for this kind introduction. And I would like to start my presentation today with a short introduction to the topic of our lecture series called Perceptions of Freemasonry. In two continental weekly journals, the German Focus and French L'Express, this week we find articles on Freemasonry, its pretended links to politics and its symbolism. Whereas the German articles that intend to explain the role of Freemasonry in contemporary German society, as well as its history and basic symbols, certainly are part of a Brownomania. The German translation of the book was released yesterday in 1.5 million copies, and the author is also interviewed in Focus. The French article maps the dangerous links between Freemasonry and politics, one of the main issues of Brown's novel itself. This is the title page of L'Express, Franc-Passant et Politique, les liaisons dangereux. No doubt this novel has already triggered a new wave of media treatment of the subject. During the last 2 years, It is the press release for this event tonight, to which I welcome you as well as director of the center, that has created the largest impact ever, with articles and radio interviews from Sheffield to Stockholm, and a request to participate in the publication of a, however, unofficial guidebook on Brown's new novel. We are happy about this interest and that you are here, but I must also remind you that we are taking a researcher's position upon the topic. Most of our lectures during this autumn will treat the question how Freemasonry was perceived and defined in a discourse ranging from 18th century journals to the internet. One of the complicated issues in researching Freemasonry is the relationship between rationality and belief, or what in our research could be called a tension between enchantment and secularization. It is this tension, by the way, one could claim, that one of the Lost Symbol's main protagonists, Catherine, the sister of Peter Solomon, is trying to bridge with her noetic science. We heard already this term mentioned a little bit earlier. Certainly we will discuss it perhaps later on. Combining the invisible potential of mind and soul with empirical research methods. Many researchers of Freemasonry have a simplified view on it as a contribution to rational processes of modernization. Others would argue that Freemasonry definitely made out an undercurrent under or complementary current to what we normally would call the Enlightenment, and that it in fact resembles religion. And I'm sure that my colleague Robert Peter will talk about this issue a little bit later in doing his short introduction. Is it possible to combine these two positions, religion and science? Distinguished Professor Margaret C. Jacob will in 15 days speak, and I have, just to remind you, we have leaflets of our lecture program here in the room. Will in 15 days speak on this subject in a lecture titled Masonic Secrecy and the Paradox of Modernity, New Archives from 18th Century Bordeaux. And we invite you cordially to this next event. 2 weeks later, on November the 11th, our own Dorothy Sommer will talk about the representation of Masonic conspiracy on the internet, most certainly one of the sources of Dan Brown's novel as well. One of the most difficult topics to treat. So congratulations for that excellent choice of lecture title. Our postdoc, Robert Collis, will on 26th of November deliver his version to the much-disputed question on how a new definition of Freemasonry took shape during the formative years of 1717, its official start in London, and 1724. Finally, our British Academy visiting fellow Dr. Robert Peter will finish our lecture series this autumn on 10th of December with a lecture on the image of Freemasonry in 18th century press. So what we are going to do tonight, our small introductory reflections on Dan Brown's novel and what happens during the rest of the autumn, we have tried to put it into one thematic frame, which is perceptions of Freemasonry. What we all have in common who are researching Freemasonry is that we're doing our research in various archives and libraries, encounter source material that is loaded with symbolism and that is difficult to decode and even more difficult to contextualize in the society and historical situation where we are finding this source material. And it would require Professor Robert Langdon to spontaneously read the meaning of this image I'm showing to you here, taken from a German Masonic manuscript from around 1765. For our purposes today, I just wanted to show you the earliest illustrations of a Masonic pyramid, which is a very prominent symbol in the book, I have found myself. Another reality we as researchers in the topic share is that we cooperate with Masonic bodies in getting access to rare source material that can tell us about the history and ideology of one of the world's largest fraternal organizations, often located in some of the most stunning edifices imaginable. This is a building that takes a very prominent role in Dan Brown's novel. It's the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C. And without knowing about the forthcoming Dan Brown novel, a certain director of research center visited this place. And as you can see, I was admitted, and also behind such nice book covers, I found this and that that was interesting to our research. This library is also described in the novel of Dan Brown. One of the final conversations in the books takes place exactly here, which is quite nice. And then, of course, this lodge room has a prominent place in the novel itself, and especially the altar that we can see here. It did not come to my mind to make a photograph of the cupola and the light that comes from above for some reason, but it is this lodge room that is described thoroughly in Dan Brown's novel, and especially this altar here. And what you can find on the altar is also pretty interesting, because you see, Dorothy already has introduced a little bit to it. What is placed on the altar is a collection of some of the most sacred scriptures in world history that are put on an equal level on this altar. And it both resembles a tolerance towards religion, but also a hermetic tradition where all the religions basically hold keys to a universal religious a truth. And I think Robert Peter will elaborate perhaps a little bit more about that later. And of course, Dan Brown is fascinated of that idea that all religions have something in common, that it makes out the foundation of our global consciousness. And this is just something that is an inscription that is to be found around this altar, the goal of initiation. Unfortunately, I didn't make photos of the rest of the inscription, so I can't tell you what the continuation is, but as you know, one of the main protagonists of the novel is exaggerating initiation into Freemasonry to the point of almost self-destruction. I'm not going to talk more about certain events in the novel, but I want to elaborate upon what I have branded seven levels of perceptions of Freemasonry that the reader is likely to find in the novel. And these altogether create an eighth perception, namely exactly that of the reader. And those of you who have read the book, I think that we all have different perceptions of what actually is written in it. But when looking at Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol as a representation of perception, various perceptions of Freemasonry, I think it is realistic to make following distinctions. And as fuel for our discussion that we are opening up after we have done our introductory remarks here, and we can later on put on this slide again. Well, one level of perceptual Freemasonry that you find in the book are exposures, obviously. Dan Brown is describing rituals, symbols, material culture, places, and buildings that refer to Freemasonry, that, as you already have seen, I mean, this building exists, it is the altar is there, there are the Masonic symbols, and so on. And so this is something that the reader already encounters when reading this novel, is that these elements of Freemasonry that are factual are in the book. The second view upon Freemasonry is the one he puts into the head of Robert Langdon as the symbologist, the Harvard professor. He is an explaining and reflective figure, and he is also very, if not supportive, he's very empathic about Freemasonry. He has basically nothing against it. On the other hand, he's idealizing some of the elements of Freemasonry. So to my mind, this is a very rare view that is represented in books like that, if you compare to other books in the genre like National Treasure, where the conspiracy theories are much more outspoken towards Freemasonry. Dan Brown also introduces public perception of Freemasonry as a topic in the book. There's one pivotal chapter where he lectures for his students about Freemasonry, and it emerges that these students are both ignorant, they don't know what Freemasonry is at all, and he has to explain, and he has very many, in Dan Brown's mind, good explanation of what it is, but also curious students who are asking questions. This chapter comes very early in the book, I think, as a gesture towards the reader, so that they are at least updated to what the professor, Harvard professor, would tell his students about Freemasonry. And then, of course, what creates the tenseness of the novel is the pretended public shock if it would be revealed that some parts of the elite of the United States of America are engaged in Freemasonry. And I know that Robert Collis will talk a little bit more about how realistic is that perceived, or this shock, so to speak. But this is a level of public perception. We also heard already from Dorothy that there is a governmental representative, the head of the secret office of the CIA, who represents a critical governmental position towards Freemasonry, the suspicion of authorities. And everybody who knows about the history of Freemasonry knows that this is a very old topic. It is at least 270 years old when the first governmental persecutions of Freemasonry in Europe were launched. Interesting enough, and we can spare that to the discussion, there's no church Freemasonry opposition described in the book at all. If you think about the earlier novels of Dan Brown, this is always a theme. Catholic Church versus the Illuminati, Catholic Church versus Langdon and the descendant of Maria Magdalena and so on. There's no Catholic Church at all in the book. And that's quite interesting. Because that would also be a normal ingredient in any novel about the perceptions of Freemasonry. We also find, which is very rare, an initiate's perception of what is going on. This person, Malak, or Zachary, as it turns out, who takes initiation to a very extreme level, yes? He not only tattoos his entire body, but does things that are not common within the practices of Freemasonry, so to speak. And he seeks that the quest for the lost words is ultimate fulfillment in self-sacrifice, and the transgression of physical borders to death, which is kind of interesting. And then we have another level of perception, which would be the Freemasons' internal perception. Some of the main protagonists, Solomon himself, the architect of the House of the Congress, and the Dean of the National Cathedral, they are all Freemasons, and they are not at all depicted as bad guys in the book, but nice people who have a worldview that is positive, and it has to do with moral self-improvement and transformation, and to become a better human being and be charitable. And then finally, and this is open for discussion, if we interpret Katharina, the sister of Peter Solomon, as a new scientist engaged with this noetic science, yes, her views upon Freemasonry is a precursor of what she's engaged in, noetic science, that reconciles the opposition between belief and rationality within sciences. And maybe is another perception of Freemasonry. So Freemasonry is a positive force in this ongoing discussion within the sciences. What can we believe in, and what can we prove with rational experiments? So I suggest that we try to remember these seven levels of perception for the discussion. And I just want to show some other images, of course. National Cathedral. And we will also address a little bit what has been left out in the book, what could have been described. And for some reason, Dan Brown did not pick in George Washington here, although he is the statue of him in the National Cathedral in front of Masonic symbols. And of course, the very important symbol that is mentioned in the book, the obelisk. And finally, the last word of the novel is hope. And this is a representation of the figure of hope in a Masonic journal of the 18th century. And I think that is the last word of my little introduction to the topic. Do you want me to switch to your images?
Sure, yeah, please. Yeah.
Yeah? Right. Thank you so much so far.
I haven't got...
Do you want to just change the places?
No, I'm happy to. Yeah, I can... That's fine. Hello. I haven't got... I'm just going to make some brief opening remarks, really, on a couple of points that interested me in the book. In particular, Andreas has mentioned one of them already, Masonic exposure. and its central place in the plot of the novel. What I found interesting was that it's a sort of, what Dan Brown has done is adapt this to the sort of YouTube internet generation, this idea of instant exposure on the internet, that it's somehow going to almost bring down the US government. And he remarks on page, I think, 434, that Masonic initiation rites had remained shrouded in secrecy for centuries. I found this quite interesting as a 18th century scholar, because you can look back pretty much from the founding of certainly Freemasonry in London in the Grand Lodge in London in 1717, and a couple of years after that you start getting Masonic exposures creeping up in the press. So for example, the second one is actually the older one, The Grand Mystery of Freemasons Discovered, that dates from 1724, and it's giving some insights into Masonic rituals and meetings. So this is just a few years after the Grand Lodge was founded in London in 1717. You're already starting to get accounts published in the press. The second one here, one on the left, dates from 1713, is a bit more famous, by Samuel Pritchard. It gives a more in-depth account of Masonic rituals. Again, early 18th century. The example on the right is actually a Russian example. It simply just says a Mason without a mask. Again, in the same vein, from 1784, exposing Masonic rituals and ceremonies for the general public. So what Dan Brown is doing, without really acknowledging it, is drawing on a long print tradition, but what he's doing is adapting it for this internet generation. You also have, I don't know if you can switch to the...
Sure.
Here we have another good example of the way Dan Brown sort of pretty much borrows from old sources. We have here on the right a French text, as it says, from 1745. Again, another Masonic exposure, revealing some ciphers used by Freemasons, which Dan Brown uses in detail over several pages, explaining the importance of these ciphers. On page 197, I think we've got here, not verbatim, but he's pretty much just copying sort of things that are already there in the press, in print, from the 18th century. So really, the twist that Dan Brown adds is a sort of 21st century twist, but it's an old tradition that goes back 300 years. Another interesting point that I found, whether or not it was relevant or not, was whether the whole US civil apparatus, the government, would actually crash to the ground if Masonic rituals were exposed. And I did a little bit of basic research on this on the internet about the influence of, say, US presidents and Freemasonry, and counted that there were 15 US presidents in the past that have been Freemasons, starting from George Washington, with the last case being Gerald Ford in the 1970s, which I found quite significant. It is about 35 years since a US president was a Freemason. And whether or not, even though I think there are roughly 2 million Freemasons in America, that's just Freemasons, let alone all the other fraternal organisations, Shriners, the Elks, etc. But whether there has been a waning in Masonic influence in US civil society in the past 40 years, and whether what Dan Brown is doing is actually giving Freemasonry more power than it actually has within the upper echelons of US society, with the CIA boss getting involved because she fears that the US society is basically come crashing down if Masonic rituals and prominent Freemasons are exposed. I think just a third and last point I'd like to raise is the issue of Freemasonry in US society and money and privilege, in the fact that Malak, very early on, somehow has this fast track to the 33rd degree, the top rank in the Scottish Rite Freemasonry in America. And it simply seems that his path to the 33rd degree is the dollar, that he's bought his way into that position in a very short amount of time. And what that says, is that a specific point that Dan Brown is raising, or is he not really aware of that himself? The issue of privilege, money, and Freemasonry in US society. Just open that out later on, hopefully, for some discussion. Pass on now to Robert. I think he gets some opening remarks.
Yes. I know that Dr. Robert Peter will talk a little bit about what has been left out of the novel, but I didn't want. I also would just show one of my reflections on that. This is an exposure. This is, of course, or not an exposure. It's a propaganda piece against Freemasonry from the 19th century, and as you can see, there's a cut off hand that also has a symbolic a place in some rituals of Freemasonry. But as you know, in the novel, there's a cut off hand and Dan Brown never does any reference to any potential Masonic background of that, which is quite interesting. But I know that Robert Peter has prepared more examples. So, yes, this is here. No, thank you.
Da Vinci Code, the lost symbol, also starts with facts. This is the very first page. So although I'm perfectly aware of the fact that this is a fiction, a thriller, while I was reading this thriller, I was taking some notes about the historical inaccuracies, some factual mistakes that are mentioned in the book. And let me highlight and let me share these factual mistakes with you. Although I must stress that these factual mistakes have very little to do with the main plot, so it's a matter of interest. First one, for example, the Rosicrucians and the Illuminati became extinct in the 16th century. These two orders did not come to existence in the 16th century. The first reference is the Rosicrucian manifestos are dated back to the mid-1610s. Dan Brown also regards John Dee, Francis Bacon, Elias Ashmole, Robert Ford, René Descartes, and Isaac Newton as Rosicrucians. Well, it's again a difficult argumentation or point, because if you just consider John Dee, he died in 1608, and the first Rosicrucian manifestos were published in 1614, 15, and 16. The Pharma Fraternitas, the Confessiones, and the Chemical Wedding. So, well before his death. Although there are several scholars, such as Francis Hills, who argue that there might be an impact of Rosicrucians on the or GD, especially his monos here, on the Rosicrucian manifestos, but it has been heavily criticized by other scholars. So if you look at, for example, Newton, he collected definitely the Rosicrucian manifestos. We can find them in his library, but he wrote about the myth or the mythology of Christian Rosicrucians and the history of that imposture. And I think he mixes up, and these persons were basically interested in Rosicrucianism, but it doesn't mean that they were members of any sort of Rosicrucian order. And the next point is the Royal Society of London, nicknamed as the Invisible College. Well, the Invisible College was a very, very important forerunner, a precursor of the Royal Society, but after its establishment in the early 1660s, it would be basically meaningless to nickname the Royal Society as the Invisible College. Also, there is a letter mentioned in the novel twice, a letter which was actually written by Isaac Newton to Robert Boyle, according to Dan Brown. It must be admitted that the letter does exist, but Newton wrote this letter not to Robert Boyle, but Henry Oldenburg, who was the secretary of the Royal Society and the founding editor of the Philosophical Transactions. So again, it's a an interesting point. Actually, in that letter, Newton criticizes Boyle because he revealed some information about the alchemical mercury, its production in the Philosophical Transactions. He published an article anonymously, and that's how he criticizes him in this letter. Again, the subtitle of Ahiman Raison, which is a very important work in 18th century Freemasonry, is misquoted. I will show you a slide later. And the last, the penultimate point I'd like to make is that more than half of the framers of the constitutions were Masons in the United States, page 29. Well, it's again an exaggeration, according to John Hamill, a leading historian of Freemasonry. Only 13 people were or were to become Freemasons of those who drafted or were the framers of the Constitution. And the last point is I'm interested in mathematics, and there is a grid, a 4x4 square in the novel, and this is a bad news because according to the CIA analysis, there are 20 trillion possibilities to decode that 4x4 grid, and I just made a calculation and it's much less than that. It's not a very difficult mathematical exercise. Okay, so Ahiman Raison, this is the correct title and subtitle, Help to a Brother, not what Dan Brown mentioned, which is a literal translation of Ahiman Raison. The next point might be a superficial perception of Freemasonry running through the thriller. On page 31, he says that Masonry is open to men of all races, colors, and creeds, and basically Masonry does not discriminate anybody. Well, it must be noted that today in Freemasonry there are several orders, so-called, especially in the higher degrees, which are exclusively Christian. The requirement to enter these orders to be admitted is that one has to profess a belief in the holy and undivided Trinity. So non-Christians, non-Trinitarian Christians cannot join these lodges. And of course, the novel also several times mentioned the 33rd degree. And in one of those exposures on the internet, I read that in that ritual, Chaim Aviv might be identified with Christ. So again, a Christian element. And also, if you are looking at the history of Freemasonry in the United States, you can also point out that Afro-Americans for centuries were discriminated by Freemasons. They were regarded, their lodges were regarded as irregular or unconstitutional. There are several Christian higher degrees in Freemasonry. This is a short list of them. This is a Christian Rosa Croix apron full of Christian icons used in the 18th degree. Langdon, Professor Langdon, also discusses on page 30 the religiosity of Freemasonry in front of his students. And of course, he proves that Freemasonry is not a religion. And I'm not sure whether he would pass the first year Robert Langdon Theory and Method in Religious Studies course at a BA level, because he only adopts one tactical definition in his very oversimplistic argumentation, which unquestionably proves that Freemasonry is not a religion. I don't want to, of course, argue that Freemasonry is not a religion. I'd like to stress that this issue is much more complicated than that. Basically, in this part of the novel, he summarizes the official position of the United Grand Lodge of England, or the Grand Regular Grand Lodges. So he poses as an apologist of Freemasonry. But there is a self-contradictory element in this, because later, although he denies that Freemasonry is a religion, throughout the novel, basically, there are many, many references to the religious aspects of Freemasonry. This is the current Masonic attitude, which I don't want to cite. Most of you are probably familiar with this position. And there are Masons today who argue that Freemasons are secular fraternity, practicing secular rituals. And there are also other Masons who say that Freemasonry works as a religion in their life. I quoted a Grand Master, for example, here. So I think if the question whether Freemasonry is a religion or not is not important. In if you are a scholar of religion, the real important question is to explore or investigate the extent of Masonic religiosity rather than to answer a very oversimplistic yes or no question that the Freemasonry is a religion or not. And there are possible possible approaches, a possible approach that I used in my dissertation. I highlighted the problems of the defining religion, defining concepts in general, and try to test some classical definitions of religion and apply them to Freemasonry. And for example, if you use the so-called substantive definitions of religion in your analysis, for example, Tyler's definition focusing on beliefs in spiritual beings, you can easily argue that Freemasonry is a religion, but there are many other definitions of religion according to which Freemasonry cannot be regarded as a religion. So, according to accepting some current trends in religious studies, I think it would be a good idea to find some sort of dimensional, multidimensional framework by which you can reconstruct the religious nature or religiosity or the extent of religiosity in 18th, or in my case, 18th century Freemasonry, but in general. Okay, the next point that I'd like to make is about the left-out arguments, which Dan Brown could easily use to prove his thesis. For example, the Rosicrucians, as I mentioned in my introduction, are several times mentioned in order to reoccur. And in 1638, there is a very famous and oft-quoted reference to the Rosa Croa. For we, brethren of the Rosa Croa, we have the Mason word and the second sight. He could have easily used this reference to prove or refer to the quest for the lost word throughout the novel. It's a key theme running through the whole novel. Or another passage, a primary source from the 1670s, referring to the fact that the Rosa Croix, the Hermetic Adepti, and the company of accepted Masons intend all to dine together. It could be another good reference for them to prove his own point. This is basically the earlier point, the quest for the word, the lost word, which is a very important theme in Masonic rituals. This is basically a theme from the Royal Arch ritual. You can see that on the bottom the letters are mixed up, and now you can see the order from chaos to order, which is again a major theme in the novel, the Yabulon, Yaqwet Yabulon. Other arguments which might have been useful to Dan Brown: Washington, George Washington installation, the first president of the United States, the Secretary of State, Robert Livingston, was the Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of New York. He used the Bible of St. John Lodge for swearing in ceremony. And at that time, Washington was a master of the lodge at that time, but he basically, Dan Brown does not refer to this fact. And also this Bible was used in the 1920s by President Harding, who took the oath on the Bible. All right, Washington and Masonic Regalia. So lastly, I'd like to contextualize the lost symbol in contemporary religious milieu, in contemporary religious context, and try to answer the question, why did Brown choose the theme of Freemasonry? And here, I'd like to make 2 points argumentation. One important factor is that the whole novel reinforces the concept of the American civil religion, which is a very important factor in the American religious national identity. I will explain this term later. And the next point that I'd like to make is that his prophetic message is in total harmony with the unchurched spirituality of our time. So let's get started just with the explanation of the term civil religion. First, the term was used by Rousseau in his Social Contract, where for Rousseau, civil religion for him was it was independent of any religion. The main tenets of civil religion were the existence of God, afterlife, the reward of punishment, and later Robert Bella, a very important sociologist, used this concept, redefined this concept, and his understanding was, as I quoted on the slide, a common set of moral understandings based upon a common set of religious understandings. So basically, this civil religion is a sort of religious dimension distinct from the churches. And Robert Bella constructed this idea after analyzing the presidential speeches. And he basically found that in every presidential speech there is a reference to God, but there is no direct connection to any religious tradition. It is important to point out that 90% of Americans today believe in some kind of higher power, and 62% of them belong to a church or a synagogue. So sociologists also pointed out that there are similarities between sermons and these presidential speeches, and empirical research also highlighted the presence and the existence of this civil religion. So in conclusion, it can be said that all segments of the population are highly affected by civil religion, and the relationship between civil religion and Freemasonry actually in the 1970s, after Robert Bella coined this term, there was an article published on the fraternal associations and civil religion, and the case study was on the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, the topic of this novel. And in this study, in this article, Louis Knowles argues that Freemasons played an important role in spreading and maintaining this civil religion. And there are several arguments why, because the concept of the deity in civil religion and in Freemasonry are very similar. For example, there's strong emphasis on the moral aspects of God. None of them is confined to any particular religious creed. None of them is restricted to any particular party, emphasizing similar national historical events in which Freemasons had a key role. They contributed to them, for example, the drafting the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, or the American Revolution in general. So the religious views of the Masonic founding fathers determine the character of this civil religion according to the authors. And in the articles that he examined in the newspapers of the New Age magazine, he found that the War of Independence was the time of the golden age of the American nation. And how does civil religion appear in my interpretation in the Lost Symbol? The sacred constitution of the U.S. was framed largely by Freemasons, according to Dan Brown. Our forefathers envisioned our great country to be a land of enlightenment. The capital is depicted as a symbolic heart of our nation. The American nation has a special role because the ancient mysteries are buried in Washington, D.C. The Masonic dean of the National Cathedral is praying for America at the end of the novel. For our Masonic forefathers, the word had been the Bible, also at the end of the novel. So the conclusion here is that the thriller promotes the idea of civil religion. And the last point I'd like to make is, again, a context. Today, in sociology and religious studies, scholars are talking about a shift, a major shift from collective to more individualized, self-constructed religiosity. I don't have time, but
2 minutes.
Yeah. So I'd like to just quote titles which would underline his point of major works. For example, the Spiritual Revolution, Spiritual but Not Religious, Understanding Unchurched America. Or again, another work, the Spiritual Revolution, Why Religion is Going Away to Spirituality. So sociologists these days argue that there is an alienation from organized religion, 40% of Americans have no formal affiliation, a religious affiliation, but it doesn't mean that they are not religious. According to Fuller, the study that I quote here, 20%, nearly 20% of American people consider themselves interested in spiritual issues, even though they never attend church. And it's very interesting that Dan Brown, in the interview that was mentioned by Andras in the introduction, answers the question exactly the same manner. The journalist asks, well, are you religious? And he said, no, I'm spiritual. Right? The very same answer, literally, that reflects the exact title of the book. So this alternative spirituality is an outgrowth of a long-standing tradition in American religious life. And Freemasonry, according to Fuller, played a very important role or gave an impetus toward this religious syncretism or eclecticism. And just really the last point, of course, this was the context and how does it appear in the actual novel. There was a church lost her way, and of course a shift from institutionalized religion towards this new spirituality. Deification of process, the single universal consciousness, a shared global vision, unified worldwide consciousness of brotherly love. God is found in the collection of many. God, as interpreters, the mental energy pervading everything, noetic science. Science and mysticism are the same according to Dan Brown or Robert Langdon, but they are using different methods. It was not a new idea at all. In the 1970s, there were several publications, the Tao of Physics, which tried to combine quantum physics with mysticism. Again, a very New Age-ish idea. It's a lost word with mystical powers in every sacred book. It's a very, of course, it's again a very important idea in the 1970s in John Hicks Lighting, who argued for a theocentric revolution in religious studies, move away from the Christocentric approach. Okay, I can talk a lot about the interpretation of these symbols, but I think the time is up, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Robert. And I think what we all can say before I hand over to Dorothy, because now you're all invited to come with ideas and questions, is that if Dan Brown just would have also put us on the editorial board of his book, we would have had a much better book. And also we have proven that we are better than Harvard professors. So, well, with my short reflections, I hand over to Dorothy again.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of questions now. I'm not sure if you really get behind it. What is Freemasonry and how do we perceive Freemasonry? But I'm pretty certain that there are a lot of people who can answer. So feel free, there are no stupid questions. Ask whatever you want concerning the book, concerning Freemasonry, Dan Brown.
I have a very curious question, which is, I read in a previous book, I think, I can't remember which one, because I read them all, so it's like, I don't remember anymore which one, that actually the president do swear, after they swear to be president, they go and swear as Masons. So, and then the interesting question, which I read in some article in the newspaper, was that Obama being black and being the Masonry in America quite against the black, especially in the South, would have been a very exceptional case, because what would happen if Obama was to be elected, because being a black person and he would have to swear as a Mason. So is this reference true? And if so, as Obama swear? How do we know?
I mean, my take on that would be the problem that we face as historians as well is to step to somebody and is a Freemason or not. And there are many rumors that Obama actually has been initiated into the American Afro-American type of Freemasonry called Prince Hall Freemasonry. But I mean, where's the proof? Yes, and there are other I mean, it's also said that George W. Bush was a Freemason. Well, is that true, or was he just a member of a Masonry mocking student fraternity called Skulls and Bones? We don't know. The interesting question for us as historians, but also in contemporary times, is, of course, does Masonic membership influence people at all in their public offices or not? Right. Yes. And Dan Brown certainly, with his novel, is adding some good fuel into that discussion when claiming, no, it does not. It's not a bad thing, and that's, so to speak, the novelty with this book, because many other stories are much more, as I said before, take a conspiracy view upon Freemasonry. So yeah.
What I find interesting, say for example in this country, is negative perception of Freemasonry in public life at the moment, I would say. But if you look back in the last 100 years, and for example, Winston Churchill was a Freemason, and King George VI was a Freemason. But in the post-war period, you get a real sort of tailing off and a negative connotations from the general public, I would say, associated with Freemasons in public life, which I don't think was there, certainly in the pre-war years. And in America, maybe that was a bit later, up until the 1970s. As I say, you had Gerald Ford, was a Freemason, Lyndon Johnson before him. But then after Ford, Carter, Reagan, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., Clinton, and now Obama, I don't believe any of those have been Freemasons. And it's as if there's a sort of slight lag. In public life in America, there is also a sort of some negative connotations, which comes out in the novel, of course, you know, it's wrapped in this,
the key phrase that you use is that you do not believe. You don't know.
Yeah, it's exactly.
It's not known, no, but there's
the key phrase that you use is you do not believe. No one knows.
No. Mm. But there's proof up until Gerald Ford, and after that, there's been absolutely no evidence that any president since then has been.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last Archbishop of England to be a Freemason was a prelate from 1945 to 1964, something like that. Well, not him, but the Fair Reverend, something or other, was quite high up in the Freemason hierarchy. He noticed that this Jar Bullock was an author, and being a member of the Anglican Church, he didn't like that, and he resigned from the Freemasons, unless they removed the Jar Bullock from the altar.
They removed what?
The Jar Bullock.
Yeah.
You know, that's an in the
yes,
triangle. Anyway, so they removed it, and he went back in again. But it's so isn't he Christianizing? Isn't the presence of this Christianizing the nation?
Well, just a second. I want to say that you can't say that there's one Freemasonry just for starters. It depends where you go to. In different nations, you have different masons and different masonries, kind of.
Yeah.
It's kind of a vessel, and it doesn't, and it's filled with the own spirit of the nation. Say, for example, I'm doing research on the Middle East, so you've got a lot of Muslims in the lodges, and you have imams and priests in the lodges. So I would not say that you can speak of one single Freemasonry that can be formed by one religious person in the lodges, but I'm sorry.
I think you are right to point out that there were a number of archbishops as bishops who were initiating the fraternity.
Yeah.
I think the one that you were thinking of was Geoffrey Fisher in the middle of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
who was a Mason, and of course the leader of the Anglican Church. And basically, I think, as far as I remember, there was a discussion in the late 1940s within the Church of England about the compatibility of Freemasonry and the Anglican Church.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly because of the fact that there were so many Muslim bishops in the Church of England, they did not want to discuss this issue further. But the late 1980s, and I think in 1987,
there was a compatibility debate, as it is called, between the Church of England and Freemasonry. And there was a group of researchers, including some sociologists and theologians, who examined Masonic rituals, including the Royal Arch. And the Church of England board criticized this syncretic phrase in the Royal Arch ritual, Iabulo and Den. I think they decided to replace the Iabulo for Yahweh. But as I'm not a Mason, of course, I just read some references to it, and I'm not sure whether it reoccurred again in the Royal Arch ritual. No idea. But there was a conflict, definitely.
I can confirm that what you say is true. But the Church of England situation was simply that it was examined by a subcommittee,
yes,
and put to the base of the Parliament of the Church of England, and they simply accepted what the subcommittee had said. But it has never been properly examined, and there were plenty of people who had other things to say about it. But at the same time, it was condemned by the Methodists and others as well.
I just wanted to then come back to Dan Brown again, and the picture I showed from the National Cathedral. In his novel, apparently there's no such conflict, in at least in the religious mind of the dean of the National Cathedral, because he's praying for America. He's a high-ranking Freemason and seems to be a prominent figure in American Anglicanism.
Yeah, he's episcopal, but at some point he criticizes the literal reading of the Bible, of course mocking the evangelical reading of the Bible. Yes.
Mm.
What's the function of the 33rd degree?
What is the function of the 33rd degree?
How do you mean?
What does it do? What's it there for?
Yeah, well, my reply would be, if I would be a colleague of mine who's researching rituals, we can say we don't know unless we've experienced it, yes? Because one of the clues of any ritual is that you cannot read a meaning into it, yes? I have not researched
Well, it's got a headquarters in London, hasn't it?
That is more than we would know. There are assumptions, I know I have read these assumptions about the third degree as a kind of a group of people across the Masonic organizations who have an order within the order. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
And again, if I would look at it as an historian, well, this was maybe the case in the 18th century, where there was an attempt to create a joint Masonic degree for the highest echelons in Europe at the time. It never had more than 1,700 members. And some people think that the third degree works in that way still. Well, we don't know, but certainly Dan Brown is riding on that idea as well. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
But if you, I thought I understood your question as what is the function of the ritual for the candidate?
No. What's it there for? What's the function of it?
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, its headquarters is in 10 Duke Street, London.
Well, good to know. Well, I
thank you.
Well, the English branch. Not
yes, sir. Another question.
How does he mock the evangelical view of the Bible?
I think he's quoting Thomas Jefferson and some deists of the late 18th century and criticizing the literal reading of the scriptures. But I don't remember exactly, but definitely he's put his words in the mouths of these Enlightenment figures.
Yes.
I haven't read the Dan Brown book. But it is laced with the same sort of errors that the Da Vinci Code is. The same sort of factual errors and egregious assumptions.
Dan Brown is saying in the same interview again that what he tries to do is selling his readers some vegetables that taste like ice cream. So he mixes fiction with fact, and that's exactly what he says. So part of it you can believe, and when he explains things of Freemasonry, I'm sure part of it is true.
But still, yeah, you have to have the thrill in it, so that's when you can fiction in it.
But there's a twist, and it's just an obvious way like he did with the previous book, the Da Vinci Code. He made all sorts of terrible mistakes with the geography of London, the geography of Paris.
I'm sure we will find the same things again.
One field of potential field of mistakes is actually left out in the book, which I wanted to return to in our discussion again, and that is that I think the word Catholic is not even in the book at all. It doesn't occur, and this is a significant difference to his earlier books, because I understand that at the very moment he's opening the door and he wants to accuse the Catholic Church of not telling the truth and being opposed to this,
it's
and
same
that.
Story again, it's not
yeah.
telling.
But it does not happen here.
No.
So there's no Catholic Church in the novel, which is kind of interesting. And I don't know if you would agree here that in not mentioning the Catholic Church, he tries to avoid the former big opposition towards his novels. I don't know what your impression was.
I mean, things like asserting that, for example, the Carlisle Island is a real good organisation when it's not.
I've got another question to do to Rob and Robin. In a way, you kind of, you said the opposite thing. Like, as I understood it, and I don't know, it's kind of conflicting. Because Rob Collis said, well, Freemasonry is not that interesting today anymore. So it's in a way like old fashioned, and he tries to hype it up away. And Robert Peter says Freemasonry is part of the whole New Age thing, which actually is coming, and there are more and more for each age, New Age groups. So in a way, so what is Freemasonry then? Is Dan Brown melancholic and takes up Freemasonry again, or is he completely up to date and takes it in a form of kind of New Age thing? That's what I'm conflicting.
Yeah, power in Freemasonry. There's the assumption in Dan Brown novel that it's necessary for the CIA to get involved to stop this thing because it's going to bring down the Americans. So power in Freemasonry, whereas Freemasonry itself, I believe there's still up to 2 million Freemasons. So, but not necessarily in powerful positions in the US government. So,
right. Okay.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I try to argue that Dan Brown, in this novel, tried to harmonize or try to create a novel which is in perfect harmony with the current religious climate. And if you look at the statistics, the sociological statistics, these days you can see that there is a significant increase in the interest of the occult, in different spiritualities. And I think he was clever in that sense that he reflected on this trend in his novel, because at the end of the day, it's a financial venture. He wanted to make a huge profit of this novel again. I can quote several statistics here. Franz Herlinger, for example, carried out a huge survey among American university students and proved that there is a huge increase, a gradual increase in the occult and the alchemy among students. Yes, this is one point. And coming back to our earlier discussion about the church, yes, it's true that the Catholic Church is not mentioned, but the message of this book, especially if you read the end, that there is this cosmic religion, that is all embracing religiosity, that every single religion agrees or moves forward, is a theologically liberal message. It's rejected by most evangelicals, of course, who are arguing for a Christocentric understanding of Christianity. So, in a way, of course, Dan Brown is in the novel as an author. You remember the interview. I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. So his vision of religion is mirrored in the actual work as well.
No, I just wanted to clarify that I think the position of the Catholic Church is that if you swear as Freemason, you are excommunicated, which means you're actually not allowed to go to paradise. Yeah. So basically, is the position of Canonical is against, completely against Freemasonry, although instead the other way around, Freemasonry accepting religion. Yeah? So it's, there is actually, I can't remember which Pope, I thought it was called Pio or something, that actually excommunicated all the people that, and the future people that would belong to the Freemasons. Yeah? So the Catholic Church is quite clear in this, that if you are one, you can be the other. Yeah? As such.
Yeah,
I mean,
I can't
remember the Pope.
Yeah. I mean, this struggle between Catholic Church and Freemasonry started basically in 1738 with Pope Clement the 12th. He was the first Pope who criticized Freemasonry, but there were several other warnings and, as you said, excommunications.
Yeah.
Later, especially in the 19th century, but actually in the late 20th century, especially the 1970s, there was a move, there was a sort of a reconciliation process starting, especially between German bishops, Catholic bishops, and Freemasons. They again started discussing the compatibility issue. And there was a document published in the mid-1970s, a Catholic document, which basically argued that it's up to your spiritual advisor whether you are a Mason or not, whether you continue being a Mason. And then it was later reinterpreted in 1983 or two. The Catholic Church issued a new canonical code. New canon, basically, and in that canon, the excommunication part was omitted, and several Catholic Freemasons concluded from this that Catholics are not excommunicated from Freemasonry. There was, I think, in that article, there was only a reference to. It says, I think, that those who carry out subversive activities against the church cannot basically receive the Holy Communion and any other sacraments in the church. So this is the canonical position. And then the present Pope, Ratzinger, basically provided an interpretation of this inclusive language in this canon. And he sent out a circular to all the Catholic bishops worldwide that this canon actually refers to Freemasonry as well. But in the Catholic hierarchy, his interpretation is basically below the canon. So it is only an interpretation reflecting his own vision, his own understanding of the relationship between Freemasonry and Christianity. Is actually very much against Freemasonry.
Yes.
But we just noted, right, that things are changing, because just this week, the Catholic Church has realized that they were wrong about what Galliano was saying. In Dan Brown's previous book, not this last one, the previous one, they were searching around for all the different symbols. Now they found out that what Galliano was saying, that the sun does not revolve around the earth, but the earth revolves around the sun. It's totally the opposite to what they were saying. So the Catholic Church has actually come out and apologized this week for their mistake that they've made.
Regarding Freemasonry being a religion, as one of the tenets, and a well-known tenet within a Freemason's lodge, is that no religion, whatever, Christianity, what any religion, is discussed along with politics.
Yeah.
If it would it not be rather difficult to conduct a religious ceremony within a lodge if we can't even discuss it?
Mm-hmm.
It sort of makes a nonsense of the there are a lot of organizations who believe in a religion. But that doesn't mean the organisation is a religion. For example, the Women's Institute is not a religion, but they have a Christian ethos. So, but getting back to my point, if you can't discuss religion, then you can't practice it, surely.
Well, that depends. I mean, of course, is there any room for discussion when you have a ritual? A ritual is, as they are described in the novel as well, is something that happens in time and space, yes, and that is predefined, and there are very little possibilities to change what is happening here. So in the ritual as such, there's no room for discussion. I think everybody agrees that the purpose of that paragraph in the 1723 constitution about discuss religion and politics was about to make sure that after the 17th century, when Europe was torn apart of religious opposition and warfare, to create harmony, yes, and basically after the ritual work. But I mean, if you have ritual work that heavily draws upon motives from the Old Testament or other hermetic traditions of Western esotericism, you come in difficulties not to adopt a definition of that what is taking place in a Masonic lodge is utterly religious to a certain extent. that would be my reply. Robert Peter is the expert. I mean, your dissertation was circling around that entire complex, but I don't know if you would agree upon my take here, or what would you reply?
Yeah, if you prohibit the discussion of religion in a lodge, it doesn't follow from this that you cannot practice or live out a form of religiosity in Masonic lodges. For example, they don't discuss religion and politics, but they pray. There is an opening and closing prayer in almost every ritual. There is an altar, for example, in every lodge where a sacred writing, the volume of the sacred law, is placed upon. I can mention hundreds of other religious allusions and references which are in the rituals themselves, although they have a fixed text, but there are plenty of references to religion. And if we are talking about rituals in general, the very idea of the ritual, Muslim ritual, can be compared to religious rites of passages. For example, baptism. If you look at the higher degrees, with all its all their symbolisms, the identification of Higher Mabith with Christ. This is a very important theme or notion known as the Unio Mystica that you can actually experience in Masonic lodges of the higher degrees by this identification. So there are a number of religious elements in Masonic rituals which from which you can't conclude that Freemason religion, although some Freemasons say that Freemason works as a religion in their lives, but you can actually reconstruct the extent of religiosity in Masonic lodges. And I used Ninian Smart's seven-dimensional framework to analyze the extent of Masonic religiosity in my dissertation, and I found it extremely useful. So there are several dimensions that we can talk about later after.
But maybe we can also ask the audience, and how far is it important at all to kind of look for the faults or for the good things in the novel? Like, I read one newsletter, a letter for the reader, from a reader of The Guardian, who said, why are you doing that? It's a good thriller, it just takes you through, you just don't want to stop reading. Isn't that what a good thriller is for? So what do you think? I mean, is that a sense of a good book? Is it then a good book? Does it have to be true to be a good novel? I mean, that's another question.
I think one of the mistakes that people make is it is a novel. And the author himself has said, he has not made any assertion that it is factual. He basically says it's a novel, and if you go on to the websites that he had, I think the website that you had, he basically says that I've picked bits from here, and it's not really factual. So, I mean, it's just like picking up any other novel and reading it.
I think
there are bits in there that are true, maybe, and there are bits that may be not true.
I think Dan Brown does it deliberately. He confuses matters with facts and fiction. I mean, I'm just looking here at him, and he, you know, it's fact is the way he ends the novel, with a series of facts, some of which aren't, I would say, facts. He says all organisations in this novel exist, including the Freemasons, the Invisible College. Going back to what Robert was saying, now the Invisible College did exist, but I would argue, I see no proof of it existing anymore.
Because it's invisible, perhaps.
May well. Well, what fact is there to suggest that there is an Invisible College existing now in the 21st century? Where does he get that fact from? And so I don't. The way he blurs fact and fiction is he does it deliberately and effectively.
But it may be appearing somewhere in the US that you don't know.
The Invisible College.
Is it dangerous? I mean, is there a danger behind it that people, maybe others, believe in what he's writing? Or is that just like, should we just say everyone is,
It's not a question, it's more just like, it's a query, and I'm thinking about Harry Potter and his Order of the Phoenix, and what you were talking about, civil religion and New Ageism, and the extent to which two phenomena, not the books, but many of the things we've been talking about this book, we could, and others, would be talking about Harry Potter in the same way. No, hidden societies, secrets, chalices, orders. Very much, perhaps, this is a kind of grown-up hotel. You know, the kids are doing this and emerging relatively unscathed. And adults will read this book and throw it in the bin.
What do you mean?
I want to ask you, a few times he mentions Newton, and obviously that is science at the time. Now, I'm not quite sure about the origins, exactly how it started in England, but am I right in believing that it is connected with Newtonian science in a way at the time? And so if it is, I think de Zagalier and all those disciples, they did not believe in the Holy Trinity. They were deists, basically. So really, to be Freemasons, which they were, and obviously for Newton, he does not believe in the Trinity. He does not have a problem with God. And as far as I could read in Dan Brown's book, and he tells you later towards the end, he says one of the things of religion, of Christianity, is that they took God and made people look up and wait for something. But God is in us, within us, something like that. And he goes on and on to tell us. Mm-hmm. And you see, he's trying to show us or find a way to a disillusioned world, as you say, we look at occult, we look at spirituality, it's absolutely, whether it's disillusioned America, whether it's disillusioned world, to say, do something, God is within us, quite a few times. And it's actually, the lost word is hope. So there is a way out, but we've got to believe in ourselves and we've got to find a different way, rather than looking at actually all this which is written in this religion, the other one, and the fanatical way. But Newton, and obviously he brings on par science, and he says that is compatible in a way. So that's how I see it.
Thank you for bringing back in this main plot or idea of the novel into the discussion, which I think is absolutely correct. Thank you very much for the contribution. Yes, and I mean, as he says in the interview that Dorothy started to quote, that is exactly one of the, if somebody has agenda here, then it is Dan Brown, because he wants us to think about that, yes, and what this big word, hope, yes. But again, and if I would see, I'm not an expert in Newton and his relationship to these traditions, other than that I've read the classical studies by Francis Yates on Newtonism and Margaret Jacobs too, of course, yes, of course, on early Freemasonry. And I would certainly say, yes, you can find that in Freemasonry, what is historically in the sources, yes? What you are arguing for, or what you say is to be found in the novel, and although there are then a high degree systems that definitely are Trinitarian and not are so much focused around the supreme being or one deity or things like that, I still think that Freemasonry's historical phenomenon was interested in that, what you're talking about. Another key concept that is mentioned in the book over and over again, both positively connotated and negatively connotated, is transformation, because one of the main figures, this Malak who ends up dying on a Masonic altar, he takes it to transformation to an extreme. Yes, he's transforming his body, but actually because he hopes that by transforming his body through a literal reading of the ritual, he will be transformed spiritually. Yes, mm-hmm. Whereas the real Freemasons and also Langdon say, no, it's not a literal thing. It's something that happens within our soul. Yes. And transformation without taking place in our soul would not make any sense. And this key word transformation, so to speak, misinterpreted by the fundamentalist approach, which I will say is represented by Malak, and the non-dogmatic approach represented by the good guys, Freemasons, also relates to what you were talking about. And transformation, historically within Freemasonry, is both a term that you would find in most of the Masonic rituals, but also in alchemy that Robert Collis has
Well, I remember last year hearing at a conference hearing a French Mason and advisor, I think, to the French government compare Freemasonry to an egg. Good food metaphor, in which you can do a lot of things with an egg. In that you can sort of have scrambled eggs, you can have poached eggs, but in a sense, Freemasonry is like an egg, and you can do lots of things with it. It can be your Newtonian form of Freemasonry in the early 18th century, but it can be other things as well. It can be a more of an alchemical, esoteric-minded Freemasonry. It can be a secular Freemasonry as developed in France, or it can be a more religiously based order, which is still the case in Britain, I believe. You still have to profess a faith in some god, in some supreme being. So I think that Freemasonry in the 18th century, certainly in London and England, may have had a Newtonian dimension that was stronger than any other, but that certainly wasn't, that was just one sort of recipe that was concocted from this egg, and that there were many other different recipes that could be brought out of this movement, this fraternal organisation. It's quite a sort of eclectic fraternity in the 18th century and still now, I think.
But isn't one of the links with Newton the fact that he was very much involved in alchemy, which also exists on two levels. One, the search for the philosopher's stone, making gold. But all that had its religious or quasi-religious kind of symbolism, in the sense that it was a spiritual transformation that was supposed to be taking place.
As far as I'm aware, Newton wasn't a Freemason, actually, or a Rosicrucian, but he was an alchemist. And an extremely religious individual interested in the Book of Revelations, etc. But I don't believe he was a Freemason. Certainly interested in esoteric issues, religious issues, and modern science.
Yeah, 2 points I'd like to make. Yes, Newtonian science was extremely important in the early 18th century. Masonic lodges propagated, advocated this Newtonian science, and members of the lodges from Royal Society explained the basic tenets of Newtonian physics to the ordinary people. So in that sense, they were spreading the new science, if you like. Newton was not a Freemason, but Desmond Gulli was a Freemason, a very good friend of Newton. William Stukeley, as extremely conservative, Anglican, was also a very good friend of Newton. He was a Freemason.
James Anderson, who wrote the very first constitution of the order, was a Presbyterian minister. And you mentioned Deism, that basically early founders, founding founders of Freemasonry were deist. Well, it is possible, I think, to provide a deistic interpretation of the constitution, but openly, no Freemason could say that they were deist or the constitution expressed any sort of deism in the 18th century, because the order would have been banned immediately. And many of them were Christians, for example, and conservative Christians, including James Anderson. There was a debate, the so-called Salter's Rule debate in 1790 in the Presbyterian Church about the doctrine of Trinity. And Anderson actually argued for the Trinitarians. He signed with the Trinitarians, disagreeing with the non-Trinitarians. And coming back to the transformation in alchemy, in Newtonian science, it's a very important thing. But I think we should differentiate between a transformation, a spiritual transformation or deification that requires grace, and the other, which basically is based on hubris, your human pride. The previous one is hardly compatible with Christianity, but the first one is, it is. So grace or hubris in this deification process, it is exaltatio.
Are there any more questions? Feel free, now it's the time for it.
I always say another note of transformation. Chapter 85 starts with the word transformation, and a cube is transformed into a cross with a circle point in it, and then Langdon discovers that it has something to do with alchemy. So, I mean, I waited while reading the novel. I waited for when does Malak engage in real alchemical workings. He never does, unfortunately. But he's talking. Langdon is talking about symbolic alchemy as well. This was just one thing to add to the transformation discussion here.
So I want to thank you all, and we've got light.
Just wanted to ask about this pyramid business. So is there really like some kind of pyramid guidance on ancient secrets, or is it like only up, or does it have like two or three Masons have something like this?
The Masonic pyramid. Who is competent to reply to that?
I have no idea, but Dan Brown says it's a fact that there's some. I believe him.
But there's someone from the audience who actually wants to answer.
Yes.
I was merely going to comment that Masonic pyramids, as far as I know, don't occur in English Freemasonry, though they have, from time to time, appeared quite importantly in French Freemasonry. Largely, I think, because of the interest in French at the time of the Napoleonic invasion of Egypt, etc., and the spiritual connotations and curiously unrevealed secrets that writing and culture appeared to offer before it was actually ultimately translated in the 1820s. Yes, it has figured in French forms of Freemasonry, but not at all in English ones. And partially, perhaps, in America.
The image I showed at the very beginning of my presentation was that this is the earliest image I have seen, 1765 around, with a Masonic pyramid surrounded by lots of symbols. Most certainly refers back to that kind of tradition that also Dan Brown is using here, but I mean, which is not surprising, because even before the real excavations of the pyramids, the entire complex of Egyptian motifs within Freemasonry, there was already a huge interest caused by one person, Cagliostro, who introduced the kind of Egyptian style Freemasonry into Europe, and he was incredibly successful with that. Yes. But there were also intellectuals fiercely opposing him, yes, because it was a very esoteric form of Freemasonry. And the image I shot relates to that more esoteric, alchemical, symbolic tradition. But even in a very enlightened circus of Vienna, where a Masonic journal was published in the 1780s, you would find a huge article about the Egyptian mysteries and how they relate to Freemasonry. So, well, there's certainly a connection between an Egyptian complex of motives and Freemasonry.
It also goes back to the esoteric tradition. Say, for example, Athanasius Kircher in the 17th century wrote extensively on hieroglyphics and he was basically an Egyptologist. Bruno was Giordano Bruno, again, was writing extensively about Egyptian. And even in the Rosicrucian manifestos, there's a sort of nothing specifically Egyptian, but Eastern flavour. The Christian Rosenkreuz goes to the East to discover truth and knowledge. So I would, you know, it goes back to early modern period, this fascination with everything from Egypt, I would say, predates Freemasonry.
But if you ask about the specific object that is described in this book, well, I would be happy to see one of these, but unfortunately we have not seen them yet.
May I just point out an article? There's no comment at all. I talk too much today. There is an article on the Masonic pyramids in a volume edited by William Weisberger called entitled The Both Sides of the Atlantic, published in 2002. There's a 30-page article on Masonic pyramid. This article proves that the pyramid that you can see in Mondor and Brill was not Masonic.
So thank you very much. Oh, sorry.
No, I just wanted to say certainly, if it's not pyramid, there is a lot of connection between with the triangular elements.
Yes.
Yeah, so there is a connection that all religion have got the same symbol, which symbolizes God in a way, and that comes from Akhenaten, that was also in the Egyptian things, and this is used even on the dollars, right? So certainly, if it's not the pyramid, but they are very, very interested into the triangular form as such, as perfection, whatever it is, and this has been all through Middle Age, you know, from the tradition to the Middle Age to nowadays, yeah? So it's kind of, you know, even Pythagoras.
So I just want to point out, if we're just talking about Freemasonry in the Middle East or whatever in Eastern Europe, we sell our lectures down there, and instead of £20, it's £15 each, or if you buy both together, it's just £25. And now I just want to invite you to some light refreshments outside.
Yes.
And thank you very much that you came.